welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Louise Erdrich has been a published and highly regarded author for nearly 30 years, but had never won a National Book Award until being cited in November 2012 for her novel The Roundhouse, the second of a planned trilogy about an Ojibwe boy and his quest to avenge his mother's rape. Louise Erdrich is the author of 12 novels, as well as volumes of poetry, children's books, and a memoir of early motherhood. Her best-selling novels include Love Medicine and The Plague of Doves. She lives in Minnesota with her daughters and is the owner of Birchbark Books, a small independent bookstore. It's a great pleasure to welcome Louise Erdrich to this week's book show.
It's a pleasure for me, Joe. Thanks for inviting me on.
What brought you to this particular subject? Ultimately, a coming-of-age story, and one of those coming-of-age stories where the adolescent is really put on a fast track of growing up.
I had knowledge of this, of the background, the political background, or the human truth of this background, for many years. It's a situation that involves difficulty of prosecuting crimes of sexual violence on reservations. But I didn't want to write a political novel. I didn't want to write a polemical novel. You see, I didn't know how to approach this at all until I began to hear or write in Joe's voice. And then it was as though the book just took off for me. I loved and felt that I was given this great gift of speaking in the voice of this 13-year-old boy. And that's how it came about. You know, I didn't really choose it. He was a character who came to me.
Did it surprise you how readily that voice of a 13-year-old boy came to you?
It really did. But then I realized that was, I was kind of a tomboy. I had my bike all those years that I could, I had my brothers. I had that freedom of growing up in a way that few kids grow up now. And I wanted to set it then for several reasons. One was that I could then contrast it, or then compare it with the fact that this situation is still the same in 2012. You know, this is still a tremendous problem. But the other thing is I wanted to set it during the first season of Star Trek, The Next Generation, because these boys love that show.
Right.
And my research consisted partly in just watching the first season.
So that brought you to 1988. That is what brought you to that time
yes,
period.
Yes, that's what brought me to that. I love eights as well. So I don't know. It was the correct year for Joe, whose parents marry in The Plague of Doves, for Joe
right.
to be around 12 or 13.
A lynching was the crime erupting in that book. Did you always know that you wanted to explore more with these characters and also more with a tragedy, and in this case, a rape?
No, I didn't know. I didn't realize that Joe was the son. I knew I had this book going when the father says, "Where is your mother?" And then I realized that, you know, this was the book that I'd been trying to write. But I didn't know for quite a while that this book was related to The Plague of Doves. And so they're related in thematically. They're about injustice. But in both books, there's a young person who is gathering power. And that's really what Joe is doing. You know, he's coming into his own, and it's accelerated through an act of violence.
And obviously that act of violence is so searing, reading about what happens to her, how it affects her, but ultimately how it affects this child.
I think that this sort of assault usually lands a woman in the situation where people think that she has got to get over it. I mean, go get counseling, go do this, go do that. Well, you know, it affects an entire family. She's unable to leave her room. She's trying to heal as best she can. And her family is trying, as they say, they're trying to reconnect her soul into her body. They do everything they can. They plant her garden for her. They bring her food. They try to recite poetry or read to her. But they don't know what to do. And she does have to come back to herself. And she doesn't know how to do it either. She's, I don't know how to come back to life.
And obviously it's something that you would never think that a teenager, a 13-year-old boy, should have to deal with, to be in that role of a caretaker. And yet, for so many of us, we find ourselves in that role, and it seems somewhat inevitable.
At the age of 13, you know, he's also struggling so hard with this attempt to differentiate himself from his parents, and yet also to protect. He becomes the protector so instantaneously, and especially when his father fails in his role to protect his mother. Joe is alternately enraged and not quite understanding where his rage is coming from. His fury is, of course, very difficult to direct because he wants to kill. He wants to destroy. He wants to annihilate the person who hurt his mother. But he can't get at that person. He's furious at his father for trying to protect him and keep him safe. And he's furious and hates himself for being furious at his mother for not being the old mom, for not being the mom, the mother, the one who is keeping their family together.
When you look at that relationship, did you think about the relationship with your children? Did you think about your relationship with your parents?
Of course, you know, my daughters are extremely protective of me, and I of them, and we have a My parents are living, and as a family, you feel this extreme level of protectiveness toward others in your family, and also a kind of ongoing dread and grief when you have parents. I feel so lucky to have my parents living, but inevitably people age, and there is the specter of mortality in every family relationship. So this, of course, was part of it. But I think more of the kind of crazy sense of humor that my family and so many Native American families have, just in the give and take between the generations, the crazy things the boys do, which really, in my mind, are totally plausible. The way people interact, the sexual freedom that the elderly have to tease the younger people, all of that is part of this book too. There's a lot of humor in this book that may be unexpected because of the subject matter.
Louise Erdrich is the author of The Round House, which is published by Harper, and our guest this week on The Book Show. It would seem to me in reading this novel that, and I'm only guessing, but that the most difficult character to write would be that of the rapist.
It was very difficult, and I consulted with a forensic psychologist. I went to people to try and construct his character, which is easily misunderstood in saying that there's something monstrous about him. It's really not that. In traditional Ojibwe society, normal people who were wonderful people would sometimes develop neuroses that made them cruel or that changed them somehow. And so one of the characters calls him a Wendigo. But it was difficult to write him and very difficult to try and put myself into his mindset, you know, into his character. But I think that's one of the things that I have just been reading a piece in a wonderful magazine published in San Francisco called The Believer. There's a little interview with Charles Dickens in which Dostoevsky asks him how he constructs the evil characters. And Dickens says, well, I have two people in me, one who is bad and evil and can do these things. And then the other is the good person who lives my everyday life. And Dostoevsky said, only two? Only two people?
At what point did you become aware of the sexual violence and how omnipresent it is and how difficult it is for women on reservations to gain justice?
I knew of this for years, and I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe this bare statistics. 1 in 3 Native women are raped. 67% of those rapes, which are mainly committed by non-Native men, they just aren't prosecuted in the least. I mean, even more of the rapes which are committed by non-Native and Native, I mean, about 88% go unprosecuted. How can this be? You know, that the fact is that now Native women rarely even report rapes because the system of justice is so broken. President Obama passed the Tribal Law and Order Act in 2010 to try and remedy this situation. And in fact, he's tried very, very hard. He's named October a month in which we should be more aware of sexual violence against women. And it's one of the things I don't think he's ever gotten any credit for. He doesn't get credit for the great things he does for Native people. Because Native people and Native women in particular are really invisible unless they're wearing Butter Maiden outfits or, so, you know, something, unless they're used to sell something.
Right.
You know, it's an invisible small population of people. But it's, of course, tremendously important to everyone who lives through this act and who lives through every family who lives through the violence.
And yet with these strides, it is safe to say, and I've heard you say this, that it's as bad now as it ever has been.
There is a bill that's really meant to address this in a more comprehensive way. And that was Patrick Leahy, Henry Reid. It stuck with the Senate and it went to the House, and the provisions that would have really helped this problem become solved were stripped out of it. So right now we're in a kind of limbo. The situation still is tremendously, I think Obama called it a national, a tragic shame. It's something that we shouldn't have in our country. But there is a lot of hope. And there was, with the Tribal Law and Order Act, there was a great deal more emphasis put on this and a great deal more empowerment of tribal governments and tribal police, so that at least there is some progress being made.
This novel, much of this novel, is told from Joe's perspective as a grown-up, looking back on the events of his childhood. At what point did that become, did you know that was the voice, as opposed to using multiple narrators, which you have used in the past, that give us that choral quality?
I do have some stories that Joe hears stories within the book, but always he's hearing the story. So he's always there to be the narrator. And I can only really say that Joe wouldn't let go of this book. So I hung with Joe, you know.
And what does having him look back, having it be in retrospect, what does that give you? Or did it create a challenge at all?
I didn't know that he was looking back until I heard him quite early on say, you know, that he had gathered all the records, that he'd looked through everything, and that this one summer of his life was really seared into his memory. And then it opened up a great deal of narrative space for me. Because, of course, if you're going to write everything in the voice of a 13-year-old boy, you're limited. So this way I got myself a mature voice that can also remember back. And that was a great help to me as a writer.
And this character, Joe, wants the mother that he had, the mother who would make them dinner and take care of the house and of the garden and be a mom.
Yeah, she also is a working mom. So, you know, there she is. She's also the center. He says, like, you know, women don't understand how much store we set by the regularity of their habits. Their comings and goings seep into our bodies, their rhythms into our bones. And so when she disappears, he says her absence stopped time. And it really is like that. Everything stops for them with this act. And while they try and restore her, they never know if their old life is going to come back.
Tell us about the character of Cappy, his best friend.
I loved writing Cappy.
Mm.
And all through the book, I understood what was the joy of having him. I made him more and more my own friend. I mean, because I was making him Joe's friend. And Joe's looking back at his best friend in these times. This is another piece of his life that, of course, he can't return to because he just loved Cappy and Joe. This is one of those basic formative friendships that some people are very lucky to have in their lives. And sometimes I see that with, you know, I have my daughters and their basic formative friendships, and sometimes with boys, it just becomes an us against the world, us, the unity and the trust in that kind of friendship is so moving to me. So in writing Cappy, I was in love with Cappy too. I loved writing him.
The book is very different than The Plague of Doves. But did you want that? Did you want a different tone? Did you want a completely different style, as a considering that it was part of a trilogy ultimately?
Yes, I did. I wrote Shadow Tag with one young narrator, and you don't know it, but that's one young narrator. So this book is related in its construction and its craft to Shadow Tag. And I wanted to write it also with suspense, because this called, you know, to get a book about jurisdictional issues in which people would yawn and fall on their faces if they had, you know, to read this book as a fiction writer, I couldn't make that exciting. I had to make it into a very human work of art that would draw people in, give them some information. I think there's very little information, but what there is important, and it sets up the situation that people can understand as the complicated situation on a reservation. But it's sandwiched between areas of suspense, and so I wrote the book with areas of suspense, and I wrote the book to give the reader pieces of information at specific moments, but yet leave new pieces of information out. So I was writing it also for myself, of course, as all writers do, in order to keep myself suspended in the book and not really even give away the ending until the ending.
And in that, you're not giving it away to yourself. It is a surprise to you as much as it is to us.
Almost. I do find in the book that, well, in this book, the last paragraph wrote itself about three quarters of the way through the book. And sometimes that happens, or sometimes I'll finish a book, for instance, Shadow Tag, and even be ready to turn it into the publisher. And then after I thought it was done, an entire 40-page ending changed the entire structure of the book. So sometimes I'm surprised, yes.
When you look at the story, do you see what is next? Do you see how you want to continue with it?
I don't always see it. And sometimes I write by hand. So one of my practices is to test my writing by seeing if I have the patience to copy my handwritten draft over again in handwriting. So within my handwritten drafts in the book, sometimes there's a repetition. And if I can stand to write it again by hand, which is somewhat tedious, not like, you know, typing's tedious too, but I have to know that it's really worth that in order to keep it going. And of course, after this, I type it into a computer and I have this ease of editing the novel. But the first editing happens in a state of all handwriting.
Writing it from pen to paper, is there a more intimate quality, do you think?
I believe there is, at least for me. I, of course, grew up writing by hand, and I think it's very important for children to handwrite and to connect, because you connect your brain down into your hand, you know, and there's something very different about the peculiarity of a person's handwriting. I mean, of course, everyone, graphologists, and everyone knows how different people's handwriting is and how much it reveals about the person.
Mm-hmm.
So if I were, you know, the czar of education, I would put penmanship way back up on the list. I think only certain schools teach penmanship. Some schools, like Waldorf schools, I know, but I think there's a very important brain, hand, thought connection going on with penmanship that keyboarding doesn't quite do, because the letters all end up the same on the keyboard, you know, and there's a connection there, but it's not for me as intimate, because your handwriting will say something about you every single day. It's different.
The circuitry can get in the way.
The circuitry changes every day for your handwriting.
Mm.
If you're excited, it tends to flow upward. If you're depressed, it tends to flow downward. You know, I developed a kind of speed writing to take notes in college, where nothing is dotted or crossed or whatever. So some of my writing when I'm very excited is probably illegible. So, you know, but I love handwriting.
The new
novel. It's going to come back, Joe.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope so.
Yeah.
And I hope it comes back without, I mean, I
learned. People will call it artisan writing.
I mean, I learned it from the nuns, so it was.
Me too.
The new novel is The Roundhouse. It is published by Harper. Louise Erdrich, thank you so much for being with us. It's a real pleasure having you join us.
A pleasure for me too, Joe. Thank you so much for having me on.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.